Thank you, Felicia, for that nice introduction. It's good to be here with all of you. Thank you for the invitation, and thank you for taking up this important topic. Many people look at sports and think that it's sort of a luxury item. I happen to think it's a really important mirror for our culture, especially right now. So I wonder if you can guess where I heard this quote. "We've always done it this way, and it works for us." If you had to guess, where would that be? Maybe a church where you're trying to change where the font is, or have Sunday school at a different time, or who knows. But this isn't a story I'm about to tell you about a church being stuck or stubborn or afraid to change. It's a story about movement and taking a chance and tapping into courage that sometimes we forget that we have or didn't ever know we have. When you're a football family, you learn how to move and how to try again. And it was another move for us, this time to Indiana, for my husband John to coach at Purdue. So I was touring the school where my son, who was then going to be in the eighth grade, would be going to school, and I asked about their sports program. And I was really looking forward to him kind of digging in, picking up with some of the activities that he had done so he could find a way to be at home there. And he was a good little cross-country runner. So I asked them at the middle school about their cross-country team. Well, we don't have a cross-country team. This is 2013. I said, okay, what are the boys' sports for the fall? Football. That's it. Just football. And for girls, cheerleading. That's it. And when I asked why, those were the only opportunities for girls and boys in the fall, they said, we've always done it this way, and it works for us. Well, it didn't work for us. So fast forward to 2015, and I was stepping into my third season as the head coach at that same middle school of their cross-country team. That first year, we started out, we had about 30 kids come out. The second year, we had 50. This third year, 2015, we had 83 kids come out for the team. Now, cross country is a great sport. It is not for the faint of heart, mostly because it hurts and it's hard. So having 83 middle school kids of all shapes and sizes and ability levels was a beautiful thing, and it was a challenging thing. Now, the first day of practice, I always made the kids run a mile under the clock. I didn't really care what their time was. I just wanted to see where they were, and I wanted them to see where they were, and I wanted them to see how it felt. And I gave them a little card when they finished at the finish line. They wrote down their time, and they wrote one word about how they felt. So on that first day, and then at the end of the season, they did it again on the last day. They ran the mile, wrote the time down, how they felt. The first day, you know, the times were on the slower side. The words were, let's say, less positive. Things like horrible, painful, torture. Those were the kind of words that were on the card. Well, this year, there was a sixth grade boy out who really did not want to be running. His parents were making him run, and with 83 kids to coach, he was a challenge because really he refused to run. I believe the word that he wrote on his card was either death or vomit. I can't remember. And he had walked most of that first mile. He had reasons every day why he couldn't run. Either he didn't bring his right clothes, or you know, he wasn't feeling great or whatever. He had homework. So we get to the first meet, and I told the team, really, all I want to see is that you're working hard. Just let me see some straining, some working, some pushing yourself. Because cross country is all about learning that you can keep going when it's hard. That's the best lesson we can learn, right? You can keep going when it's hard. So it's the last stretch, and this little sixth grade boy is in dead last. I mean, by, like, a lot. And he had walked most of the course. So here he comes around the home stretch, and 80 of his teammates run over to just flock around him. You can do it! You can do it! You can finish the race! He stopped, he crossed his arms, and he sat down on the course. He wasn't moving. I ran over to him, and I sat down on the ground, and I said, "What do you need right now?" And he said, "I need them gone." He wanted all his teammates to get away. I say, "Everybody, get away. Lee, okay, great job. Give him some space." I said, "What's going on?" He said, "I'm in last." I said, "Yes, you are." He said, "I don't want to do this." And I said, "You're in last. That's where you are right now." I said, "I don't really care if you're in last. If you don't want to be last again, we can do something about that. This can never happen again if you don't want it to. But today you're in last. And I don't care if you come in last every single race. What I care is that you don't give up. Are you going to give up?" And he just looked at me, and he got up, and with the maddest look on his face, he finished the race, spoke to no one, went home. And that night I decided, that kid is tough. That kid's got some inner resources that he needs to celebrate, and we need to celebrate. So I made up a new award. You know, mostly we just recognized our top runners and people who made their times. Well, I made up a new award. I got a big shovel, and it was the Dig Deep Award. And he was the first recipient of the Dig Deep Award on that team, and it became a very coveted award that everybody wanted. Now, last meet of the season, the county championship. This guy took 10 minutes off of his time. He did not come in last, not even close to last. And he kicked it in the home stretch with the whole girls' team lined up, cheering him on. This is why I love sports. This is why sports have had a hold on me since I was a little girl. Because they give you a way to practice the thing we need to practice the most. Believing that each of us has the capacity to face whatever challenge comes our way. That we can keep going when it's hard. Now I wonder why sports have a hold on you. Maybe you don't think that they do. Maybe you're a person who really doesn't like sports much. Maybe you wonder what all the fuss is about for people. And so for you, the question may shift to be more about why is it worth your time to explore why sports matters to so many people. So really the question for all of us is what is at stake in this conversation about sports and Sunday? And for me, the conversation is about much more than sports. It's really about what it means to be human and how we find spaces in which we can practice being our best selves. And the bigger question for us today is what happens when those spaces are co-opted by the capitalist enterprise? And what can the church learn from how sports touch human lives at such a deep level? So today and tomorrow, we want to let sports hold up a mirror to us and tell us what we need to hear about the larger culture. Tell us what we need to hear about who we are and who God is calling us to be. Now, I need to tell you all the truth about something. This conversation is a bit tender for me right now. I spent most of my adult life in professional sports, and most of my life previous to that revolving my life revolved around being a competitive athlete. So right now, since my husband left football, and we have changed our life and we're now not in that world anymore, it's a huge adjustment. And I'm honestly grieving, still trying to understand what it means. I think we made the decisions we made for reasons that were right and good, but it is a big loss. And the rhythm of my life still feels really awkward. So I hope you'll just hold me tenderly in that way. We invested a lot of time and energy and love. And in many ways, it feels like I have recently returned to Earth from a different planet. A strange alternate reality with alternative facts and all that stuff too. And we tried to normalize it over time, which makes everything that's happening in our country right now eerie to me. It's like, I've seen this movie before, but there are just different actors in it. We have a lot of ground to cover these next 2 days. Today we're going to spend some time unpacking how sports and the human condition are tangled up with each other. And we're going to think about why we, in particular, people of faith, need to look at that with intentionality. We're going to look at also what this means for us as Presbyterians in this particular cultural moment in which we are being called as a denomination, as a people of a particular tradition, to engage in some earnest self-reflection, perhaps some repentance, and God willing, maybe even some rebirth and resurrection. Tomorrow we're going to look more closely at how sports and congregations have affected one another. Are soccer tournaments really to be blamed for the demise of Sunday school? I'll just let that sit. So, I want to give you a few tips here as we move on. First of all, remember what Cameron found out about himself. You can keep going when it's hard. There might be some things about this conversation that don't really sit very well with you. You may feel that you don't agree with some things that I say. And I want to know you to know that I honor that, and I celebrate that, and I welcome that. And I also invite you to explore what a different perspective might have to offer to you, even if even if it's not something that really sits well with your perspective. My coach in college always told us, when things get hard, think about that you've maybe cut off or bitten off too much to chew. So he said, remember, inch by inch, life is a cinch. Yard by yard, life is hard. So on cross country, that means instead of trying to run to the finish line, run to that tree over there. Then run to the next fence post. Then run to the next whatever. And so that's what we're going to do today. We're going to be incremental. We're going to look at some different pieces and see where it gets us. The other thing I want to invite you to think about is that a win today is not about someone else losing. Winning is a practice in a theological discourse. It's about wondering, investigating, and noticing. That means we're opening ourselves up to what we might have to learn from some surprising places like sports. Sports are a great teacher for us, and they hold a mirror up for us. But we're not just exploring sports. It's just your everyday Joe on the street. We're theologically minded people, and so we need some theological terms. We're going to use the term apocalypse to define our mode of exploration. Now, apocalypse can often be mistaken for a sense of foreboding, that it's the end of the world, that You know, everything's just going to hell in a handbasket. Apocalypse is really about the truth. It's about unveiling the truth. And it is, I like to say, about instruction rather than destruction. Apocalypse is an opportunity for us to change. It's an opportunity for repentance. It is truth that can convict and transform. It's not the end, it's a beginning. And it reveals distortion and redemptive possibilities, and that's what we're on the hunt for, redemptive possibilities, via looking at some distortion. Now, there's a couple things I want to just get out in the open about my theological understanding of the human condition. I'm an embodiment theologian, so I start with the body. And I believe that we are bodies that hold both tragic and redemptive capacity. Our minds are a very little piece of our experience. There's so much about our experience that we never have conscious access to. We're tangled up with each other. We're tangled up with everything that is. We are interdependent, radically relationally made beings. And tangled up in who we are is God, this transcendent, holy creator. And so the more we live into that unique and utter dependence that we have on God, that is literally entangled in the way that our bodies are made and the way we are made, the more we flourish, the more we live into who we were made to be. And divine dependence, as I call it, is defined by practices and mentalities and modalities in which we put God at the center. We know who we are. We know our place in the scheme of things. We know who God is. Schleiermacher is one of the theological fathers of these sensitivities, and also Alfred North Whitehead. Schleiermacher calls this absolute dependence on God Gefühl, or feeling, the feeling of absolute dependence on God, that we are not free agents. We are tangled up beings. And the more that we practice that, the healthier and more robust and Schleiermacher would say pious we are. And so that is kind of the key to how we understand the creation of wholeness. Is this more kind of integrated way of understanding? Now, we're Presbyterians, so we can't stop with all that good stuff. We got to talk about sin and idolatry. I appreciate Tillich's understanding of the demonic, and that has deeply informed my work. For me, what's important about the demonic, Tillich's understanding of the demonic, is that it helps us remember that the demonic is not something outside of us. It's within us. And it's our penchant for distortion and illusory ways of thinking. So what the demonic creates in us is this kind of muscle twitch that tempts us over and over again to make ourselves the center of the universe, to make something that is finite into something that to which we attribute infinite importance or an infinite quality. So this kind of consuming the universe into oneself, or concupiscence is another word for that, and that Tillich uses, this creates a distorted, you know, really kind of trivialized understanding of who we are and who we are in the world. The demonic blinds. It does not reveal. The demonic is also really tricky because it can take something that is a good, like knowledge, like sports, and turn it into something that it's not. And then it begins to work its way into this really distorting kind of modality of being in the world. So these are some of the terms that are going to help inform us as we explore sports and the human condition this morning. So let's take a look at what's going on with this whole sports thing in this culture. Why are sports a more compelling option for people, for lots of people, on Sunday mornings if they're presented with the choice? While church attendance is declining, participation in sports is increasing. While Sunday schools are becoming a relic of the past, soccer leagues are really becoming like this part of growing up, you know, as everybody does the little travel soccer team. Sports is something that has deeply affected and has been deeply affected by mainline Protestantism. Now, I want to shift away as a theologian of the body. I want to look at this from a visceral level. I don't want to just look at it from a kind of sociological level or trends. I want to look at the gut. You know, where is it hitting people? Where does it feed people where they're hungry? And this is where I think the church has really struggled to meet people. And that is in this deeply embodied yearning and hunger to generate visceral data. And by that I mean have experiences that the body downloads into its hard drive that changes the way we feel about ourselves, the way we feel about people next to us, the way we feel about the world. And that's what sports does. People generate visceral data when they engage, whether it's playing or participating in something and they get their endorphins moving, or they're a fan and they're at a game and their blood pressure goes up because their team just almost lost. I'm not even going to get into basketball after last night. I'm just like, yeah, I can't go there. So, no, I can't do it. I can't do it. I want y'all to like me. I can't do it. Okay, let's keep going. I know. Maybe another time with the bottle of wine or something. You're not what? Oh, again, we'll get into that later. Okay, good. It's good to know that we're in a healthier space than that, then. All right. Now, mainline churches, and this is a lot of my work has been really about how mainline churches have struggled to meet bodies, where bodies are. And so this is really where I feel like sports has something to say to us that we need to listen to. Full-bodied participation, a deep sense of connection, vitality, transformation. These are the things that we say we're about as a church, but how do we actually practice that? How do people actually feel that when they come to church, when they intersect with their communities of faith? Let's look a little bit kind of at a genealogy of what is the inheritance of the role that sports has in our culture. It's really a hybridized inheritance that we have. We've got, you know, kind of Roman artifacts, we've got Greek artifacts, we've got British, and then we've done our own little special thing with it here in a capitalist culture. So let's start with the Roman Colosseum. The Roman Colosseum was a place in which the state and the citizen figured out and proved and reiterated who they were over and over again. This was part of the purpose of the Colosseum, was to create a spectacle in which the might of the Roman Empire was reiterated over and over again. And everything mattered in the Colosseum, where you sat, who you sat next to, who was in the, you know, in the round there, who sponsored who. They actually did have sponsors of their gladiators. And this was almost a tick of that culture to keep having these battles in which the exotic other was destroyed by the Roman Empire. Over and over again, people were reminded that if you are not conforming to our values and standards, you will be slayed. You will be destroyed. And so the self and the state constantly did this dance of remembering their place and remembering what it meant to live into this kind of power as domination. Because you see, this is all about power and agency. And even the spectator has agency, has power. And the Roman Colosseum really is part of the kind of ethos of sport that we see reiterated in our Colosseums, in our stadiums. It doesn't take that much for us to see some parallels. Everybody's kind of on the stage. Everybody's participating. Everybody has a role. Even if your role is to wave your towel or to scream louder or to tell the person who's saying things they shouldn't be saying to sit down or whatever it is, there is a self that gets constructed and reconstructed in the stadium, in the Colosseum. Now, some of the ways that this ethos bubbles up in our culture comes around these very toxic emotions like fear, anger, despair. These are some of the ways that the self is constructed and reconstructed. With new challenges, new viewings, how are we going to deal with fear? How do we deal with anger? How do we deal with despair? How do we deal with disappointment? How do we know who's on our side? How do we know who we really are and how we really deal with disappointment? Now, this kind of forging of identity is really what I want you to take from Rome. Now let's look a little bit at the Greek influence. For Greek culture, the athlete was the sort of paragon of excellence, virtue, even transcendence. The great athletes were a way for us to kind of catch a glimpse of the almost godlike qualities that human beings had to succeed. And so sports was wrapped up with virtue and virtue on display. In Britain, sports began to be a container of the colonial impulse. In other words, sports become a carrier of culture. This is how we share our culture with other cultures that we would like to colonize. So in Britain, the focus really was on how sports helps to teach and reiterate the virtues of empire. How do we teach people how to be loyal to authority? How to play by the rules? How to serve the empire? And how can we infiltrate other cultures with these values? And so the performance of virtue, the performance of colonialism and empire, all of these things are part of how we understand and how we practice this kind of dynamism of sport in our culture. And then we kind of overlay our own unique, it's just American. That's, you know, what it is. We have turned this phenomena into a commodity. It is a product. It is a commodity. It is entertainment. It is a profit-generating, revenue-generating dynamic in our culture. And so what does that mean? Well, that means those who are the revenue generators, in other words, those who allow this product to be lucrative, are commodities. So bodies become commodities. And a lot of the bodies, in fact, most of the bodies that are commodities in the most lucrative sports are black and brown bodies. And they are generating revenue and wealth for mostly, almost exclusively, white bodies. So, right here, we've got a window into the fact that this genealogy of sport, the culture of sport that we have inherited and then made our own, is a carrier of some of our worst distortions. And it is a mirror of both our kind of hyper-masculinity that has helped to define our culture, our racialized biases, our streams of wealth, and most of all, that you can justify a lot of morally reprehensible behavior if it's going to make you some money. That is really one of the things that sports unfortunately reflects back to us over and over again. So sports are both a carrier and creator of culture, and they've been thoroughly infiltrated by the capitalist enterprise and by white supremacy culture and by patriarchy. And we can talk more about this however you would like. So what this brings up for us is we really need to pay attention to how power gets used and abused in sports. Just a few marks that we've already talked about: the commodification of bodies, the commercialization of values and virtues and norms, the reification of gender binaries and racialized biases, and this also kind of less obvious layer in which power gets learned. How do we use power? What does good power or effective power or impactful power looks like? Remember, everybody has power. Power is not a moral category. It's simply a capacity to have an impact. The moral quality of power comes in terms of how it's used and what effect it has. Abusive power is really the thing that we're on the hunt for, right? That's the thing we should be against. How power gets abused. How has white supremacy culture infiltrated the reality of sports? Well, it's some stealth ways and then some pretty obvious ways. But two things I want you to keep in mind as we move forward about how power and what power that is impactful looks like, how it works in sports. Two things. One is white culture privileges a focus on individuals instead of groups or systems. In other words, independence and autonomy are valued and rewarded. An individual is in control of their environment. You get what you deserve. Okay? Now, those all probably sound like fine values. What's wrong with that? That's just good old individualism. Well, the problem is we are also living in systems and institutions that exacerbate racialized disadvantage and gender bias and things like this that make some people and their ability to have agency and individual culpability and capacity not as robust as others. In other words, some bodies carry the weight of this iteration of power in a way that creates disadvantage. And we'll talk a little bit more about this as we move on. But the other mark of white culture is that the way decisions are made reflects this assumption of white culture that power over is a good thing. power over is a good thing, and that those who are least affected by the decision are the ones who have the most power in making the decision. And that we see all over, especially college sports, that those who are least affected by a decision have the most power in making the decision. Those who are the most affected by a decision have the least power in making a decision. So, now let's get to idolatry. First, we have to start with the fan. Anybody in here a fan? Let's spend a little bit time unpacking this term fan, okay? Now, I just want to out myself. I'm not a fan. I was a coach's wife for over 20 years. I am not a fan. That was a very different existential situation to be a coach's wife. Fans have teams that they care about, and, you know, kind of like Doris was saying, it's like through hell or high water, you know, that's your team. No. Whoever was paying us a paycheck, that was our team. I mean, I'm just being honest, okay? And then if they fired my husband, they were dead to me, you know? We're out. We're done. I remember when we left the Chicago Bears and went to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And we were supposed to playing the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in Tampa Bay. And I'm walking in with my little baby. I've got a newborn baby and my little four-year-old, and we're walking into the game, and I run into the Bears team doctor. And we were there for, you know, several seasons. So he's like, "Oh, hey, Marcia, today must be a hard day for you." And I was like, "Why?" And he was like, "Well, because, you know, it's Chicago and Tampa, you know, that's hard. You must feel divided." I said, "No, I don't." And he said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "The Bears fired my husband. We're going to kick your butt today." And I kept walking. And we did. Oh, sometimes it feels good, but... So let's let the fan speak to us about power and the human condition. Let's let it talk to us for just a minute about our capacity for distortion and redemption. Now, some people use this word fandom. I think that's sort of a softened moniker that I don't want us to use that today. Fan comes from the word we don't like to say, and that's fanatic, okay? Fandom makes it feel kind of normal and maybe even sanitized, but really it's fanatic, okay? And the important thing for us to remember is that this is a religious way of being. Yes. It comes from the word for temple. Okay? It is the frenzy, the zeal that one has in the temple. So that kind of enthusiasm, the difference for the kind of contemporary iteration of fan that we're trying to explore today is that the original intention of this is that the frenzy, the wince of that frenzy, is God, or a God, some kind of deity, some kind of transcendence. Remember that demonic distortion thing? When we make something that is not infinite into something that is? When we overlay this zeal, this impulse to make it everything to us, then it becomes idolatrous. So in some sense, this kind of contemporary iteration of fanaticism or being a fan or, you know, whatever we want to call it, fandom, it is embedded in this, in idolatry. Now, I'm not trying to be so hard on everybody. I mean, I don't want to take away all your fun. It's okay to love sports. It's okay to love sports, and I think it's even important to love sports. But the very understanding of idolatry is that there is a proper way to direct our yearning and our hunger, and it is toward God. And that how, so the question for us today really comes down to, if our yearning is not to be idolatrous, then how does it become properly channeled? How do we take this and let it channel something toward the direction it's properly, the direction it properly should be moving to us toward? That is a question we can't totally answer today. We're going to look at it a little bit more tomorrow. But while we want to look at what makes sports religious for people, or what brings up this kind of religious afterglow for people that in their participation in sports, we need to ask instead, how can sports begin to form and feed a devotion to God or some kind of expression of transcendence? How can sports help us to cultivate practices that help us remember and embody our place in the scheme of things? There are three things that I feel like are really marks of an incarnational faith. And so these are kind of the ways that this is sort of the metric that I use. Does it increase our sense of vitality? Really, really our sense of vitality, not just, you know, a quick little buzz, but does it really feed a robust ability to be alive over time? Does it help us feel connected, and not just connected to people just like us, but all kinds of people, and more important, to God? And is it transformative? In other words, does it make us better people? In other words, how do sports cultivate the image of God in us? So really this all brings us to where we're going to be tomorrow, which is to look more closely at how sports and congregations have affected each other. There is a danger when sports become too important without a kind of proper wince and goal or end of diminishing returns. And I have been up close to what some of those diminishing returns look like. And I would love to talk to you about it some more. I hope you'll all be here tomorrow so we can get into it. But I think as people of faith, we need to be concerned about the kinds of diminishing returns that are happening for young men of color in our institutions of higher learning. We need to be concerned about the diminishing returns that are happening for people who don't fit into gender binaries in the world of sports. We need to be concerned with how people all across the gender spectrum are expected to conform into these very hyper-genderized, you know, roles. Those things do not cultivate a robust understanding of our own capacity to be alive, our own capacity to be ourselves. These are things we need to pay attention to as people of faith, and we don't often. We often get distracted by the glittery stuff of commercialization. Why do coaches get paid so much? Why is there all this glitz and glamour? Why do we have all the commercials? Well, we have that because people pay for it. The more interesting question is underneath that. If this is something we value, what does it say about us? There must be something comforting to us about the reification of racialized bias, hypermasculinity, patriarchy, consumerism, the commodification of bodies. There's something familiar about it, even if it's abusive. There's something that feels good about a place where everything makes sense. We know where we fit. We know who's for us. We know who's against us. We know who's them. We know who's us. And even when there are things that just don't smell right. We see what we want to see. So tomorrow I hope we can take a closer look at what have congregations to say back to the world of sports. And, you know, what's the truth about this whole travel soccer thing and its effect on congregations. Thank you all so much.